I do make it a policy to not be too dependent on my PowerPoint, because these things get gremlins, and that's no fun to try to fix on the fly, as Alan well knows. Lots of fun, but hey, there we go. I'm still going to black it out, though. That's it's all right. We all need it, though. Okay, so we have been talking about Esther. We are the third lesson in the series now. We've got this one and then two more to go. But this is the second of two lessons on providence within the book of Esther. I think it's fitting to spend two of our lessons on this subject because it really is why the book is written. It's the main point of the book, to teach us about God's providence, to teach us that God is working even when we don't see him, and even when we are not sure exactly where he is or if he is working at all. He is still there. We looked at the God-shaped holes found in the narrative last week and found some coincidences that are really more than coincidences. They are places where God's name is not mentioned, yet we do see his presence. But there's some more that we need to talk about providence in the book of Esther. And we're finally going to get to something that I've been talking about this whole time, the central chapter in the entire book, and that is Esther chapter 6. We have been skipping over this chapter again and again as we're talking about it, and it's the most important one. So we're going to spend almost all of our time in that chapter this evening. That being said, we're not going to be there right at the beginning. So go to Esther 3 for just a moment. I want to give us some context again for what we'll be talking about. We need to remember Haman's plot. So Esther is already the queen. She's already in this position to be able to help, even though she doesn't know there's going to be a problem yet. And in Esther chapter 3, verses 8 through 11, it says, "Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries.' So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, 'The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as seems good to you.'" So Haman has this deep hatred for the Jews. And really, his hatred for the Jews is because he hates Mordecai. And he only hates Mordecai because Mordecai wouldn't give him the appropriate respect and reverence that he deserves. He would not, grovel before him as he passed by or anything like that. And so Haman goes to the king, and I want you to notice something really interesting here. He doesn't even name the group of people that he wants to exterminate. Nowhere in here does it say that the Jews are the ones who need to be exterminated. So I want you to put yourself into the king's shoes here, and your advisor is telling you there is a certain group of people in the nation who need to be destroyed. And the king says, okay, sure, go for it. It's weird. We'll have more to say about this next week in particular, but King Ahasuerus is a bumbling fool all throughout this book. He's really not a very good king, and he makes a lot of extremely questionable decisions, like putting such blind faith and trust in his grand vizier that he'll do literally anything he says. In this entire book, he never tells anyone no. He does whatever anyone tells him, of any rank, from any position. He is basically commanded like he's a common person, even though he is the king. So Haman knows he doesn't even really have to tell Ahasuerus who it is he wants to kill. Just give him some threadbare excuse. There's a people here. They don't want to follow your laws. They're dangerous to the kingdom. We should get rid of them. And the king says, go ahead, you have the authorization to do so. But we see that this is not enough for Haman. Now, Mordecai is a Jew, so Mordecai would get caught up in all of this. His fate is already sealed, because Haman has the authorization to kill the Jews. Mordecai is a Jew. You know, in short time, Mordecai will be dead, but that is not enough. Over in chapter 5, verses 9 through 14, this, by the way, is right in between the two banquets that Esther invites the king and Haman to. So Haman's already been to the first banquet. Esther's already scheming and plotting to be able to overturn his decree to kill the Jews. But Haman is going to throw a wrench into the works here by doing something that Esther doesn't know about. In Esther 5, 9 through 14, Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So, even though Mordecai is already going to die, even though Mordecai's fate is sealed, it is important to Haman that Mordecai dies faster and very publicly. He wants Mordecai disgraced. It's almost comical what is happening here. If it weren't so violent, if it weren't so bloody, that Haman has everything he could imagine, everything he can want. He's the second most powerful person in the kingdom, and Persia was a pretty mighty kingdom at the time. He is outplaying the king at every hand, so even though the king is technically above him, Haman pretty much can do whatever he wants. He has a lot of money, a lot of power, a lot of respect from almost everyone in the kingdom. But because Mordecai won't rise and tremble before him, it's all worthless. He goes home, and I can just hear him complaining to his wife and his friends. I have so much. I'm so wealthy. I'm so powerful. I'm so respected. But as long as Mordecai lives, it means nothing to me. Very melodramatic. You can see the arrogance that Haman has. And Zeresh, as any good wife would do, just stokes that ego and gets him pushed all in the wrong direction. She says, well, if what's going to make you happy is killing Mordecai, then kill Mordecai. Make a gallows 50 cubits high and go ask the king tomorrow morning to kill Mordecai, and he'll probably say yes. Now, I want to make a little note here. You're probably trying to imagine what a 50-cubit gallows looks like. If you know what a cubit is, about that's 18 inches, this is 75 feet tall. And if you know what gallows are, that is fairly comical to imagine. These weren't gallows. That's a really weird translation. I don't know why that is translated that way in a lot of English translations. The Persians didn't do that. They didn't have gallows that they would hang people from. What these were tall, sharpened poles. They're just poles that stick up in the air, sharp on the end, as if they were giant spears or giant stakes. And what they would do is when they executed someone who needed to be publicly disgraced and made an example of, they would impale their body on top of that and leave it displayed as it rotted. And that was to show everyone, don't get in trouble. Don't cross the king. Don't be an enemy of the state, because this is what will happen to you. That's essentially the same thing what the Romans did with crucifixion. I mean, there was a whole torture aspect to it, but then they would leave the bodies there to hang on the side of the road, and there would be crosses all up and down the roads around the cities, reminding people, don't rebel against Rome. This is the same concept, just a different implementation. And that's what that's what Haman wants to do with Mordecai. He wants him publicly disgraced on this very prominent way of displaying his dead corpse. It's violent. It's bloody. It's kind of disgusting to think about. But that's what he wants. So, this gets us to chapter 6, finally. There's a lot going on in chapter 6. It's an extremely important chapter. It's also a bit of a puzzling chapter because it's going to challenge some of the assumptions we make about the book of Esther. For example, you might think, very naturally, that the heroes of the book of Esther would be Esther and maybe Mordecai. They're kind of the main characters. The book is literally named after Esther. We have this nice story of how Esther rises to become the queen, and she saves her people, and Mordecai is the one who helps her and gets her in that position and encourages her to do the right thing. And we applaud that Esther has saved her people. Esther's not the hero of Esther, believe it or not. And chapter 6 proves it. Esther is important, and I'm not trying to downplay the good that Esther did. We already had a whole lesson at the beginning of this series talking about Esther's growth as a person and how her boldness, her courage, was so important in saving her people. That's all still true. But Esther's not the hero, and neither is Mordecai. And the first problem that we're running into here is, you remember how a couple weeks ago we talked about that Esther worked up her courage. She had been pushed by Mordecai to do the right thing. She'd resolved to do the right thing. And she took those 3 days of fasting to plan, to come up with a scheme that would save her people. And it's a good plan. We already talked about how effective it was and how she was very careful with the way that she framed her request to get what she wanted out of it and to discredit Haman at the same time. But you know what didn't happen? She didn't know what Haman's other plan was. We'll get to that as we go. Let's see what happens in Esther chapter 6. Let's start reading verses 1 through 5. Esther chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. On that night, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So we have a few strange and coincidental things that have happened here. Ahasuerus is lying in bed, restless, unable to sleep. He's struck with insomnia. That's not unfamiliar to most of us. But he just cannot get to sleep. And he makes kind of a strange request here to try to overcome his insomnia. To resolve this, he asks for the court reader to come and to read to him the chronicles of his kingdom, the records of things that had happened over the course of his reign. I think there's just a small bit of irony here that he finds the records of his kingdom to be so boring that it might put him to sleep. Maybe that says something about him as a king. I don't know. But that's what he chooses to do to try to get over his insomnia and to be able to be bored to sleep. But it doesn't really work. We see this goes on all night. We already know that Haman was going to come to Ahasuerus in the morning And this goes on until Haman arrives. So Ahasuerus is up all night long. He doesn't get any sleep. He is struck with this insomnia that cannot be cured, no matter how boring the chronicles are that are read to him. Yet something very interesting and very decidedly not boring is read to him. The account of the failed assassination attempt. You may remember that we talked about this, that Mordecai, in the course of his job there in the king's gate, he overheard a plan by two of the king's eunuchs to assassinate Ahasuerus. They were angry for some reason. We're not given the reason why. But this is a concern for most any world leader of any country, of any point in history. You make enemies when you are powerful. And Mordecai heard about this. He passed the news on to Esther, and Esther passed the news on to the king, and his life was saved. The eunuchs were able to be punished for their crime, their attempted murder. Ahasuerus now remembers this. I don't know how you forget about a failed assassination attempt. I feel like that would stick in my mind. But for him, it does not. He has forgotten all about it. And he says, was anything done to honor Mordecai for doing this? Now, you need to know why he asks this. In the Persian culture, and in a lot of ancient Near East cultures, the principal characteristic that was important to them was honor. The honor-shame dynamic was extremely important to them. And that's important to us too, but not the same way that it was to them. And there are still some places in the world today where honor and shame are the most important things. So what I mean by that is everything that they did kind of subconsciously was filtered through this idea of what brings honor to me, what brings honor to my family, what brings honor to my community, my nation, and conversely, what do I need to avoid because it will bring shame to me, shame to my family, to my community, and to my nation. There's nothing worse than bringing shame upon any of these parties. We probably think about that sometimes, but I would say that the American ideal that is the most important is that of freedom and liberty. That I can do whatever I want to do, and what I prioritize is what's going to advance my own interests, what's going to benefit me the most. I want to avoid doing evil things because, well, that might interfere with my freedom to keep doing the things I want to do. I might be put in jail. We don't as readily think about bringing shame to our families or shame to our communities. We instead think about it in more personal terms. And there are pros and cons to both of those. That's just cultural constructs there. But for them, honor and shame was extremely important. And when Ahasuerus realizes that Mordecai had never been honored for saving his life, he realizes a great mistake has been made. See, this is not just an insult to Mordecai. By not honoring Mordecai when honor was due, he has brought shame to Mordecai, and in turn, he's brought shame to himself and shame to the kingdom. What kind of kingdom is it that wouldn't reward a man for saving the king's life? This is a very serious offense, and one that Mordecai is probably offended over, and one that Ahasuerus realizes could seriously damage the reputation that he has and his nation has as a whole. So this needs to be resolved. By now it is morning, and he's deeply troubled. He wants to know, how do we fix this? So he asks, is there an advisor here? The subtext is to tell me what to do, because that's what Ahasuerus does at every turn, look for somebody to tell him what to do. Is someone here to advise me on this matter? And the servants who are there say, why, yes, Haman has just walked in. And now we have some tension that has built up. Recognize the that there's about to be a conflict. There has to be, because Haman is coming in to follow Zeresh's recommendation that he's going to ask for Mordecai to be killed. And Ahasuerus is about to ask Haman, what do I do to honor Mordecai? However this is going to end, it's going to be interesting. There's not an uninteresting way that this can end. So let's continue on in verses 6 through 9. Esther 6, 6 through 9. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought that the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse throughout the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Ahasuerus asks Haman what he should do for a man whom he wishes to honor. The wording here is important. The wording is why the story turns out the way it does. Because Ahasuerus is just vague enough here to cause a whole misunderstanding. It's like the who's on first thing from Abbott and Costello. That everyone thinks that they're talking about something different, and it's a whole mess and a comedy of errors. Ahasuerus asks, not, what should I do to reward Mordecai? But what should I do to reward a man whom I wish to honor? It's a weird way to say that. And I do not believe that this was a plot by Ahasuerus, that he is doing anything particularly genius here to try to trap Haman. I don't give Ahasuerus that much credit. I'm not sure he's capable of it. We don't see any recognition that he knows that Mordecai and Haman have anything against each other. He doesn't know that Haman is here to ask for Mordecai to be killed. And quite frankly, Ahasuerus hasn't done anything competent in the entire book. So I just can't believe that he's suddenly come up with a master plan to trap Haman in a plot that he doesn't know anything about. Yet, this is the way it comes out. This is the way he says it. It's vague. It's a little strange. And when Haman hears it, the king wants to honor a man. His head is so swelled that the only person he can think of that the king would ever want to honor is himself. Haman is that important, that wonderful, that the king loves him best of all. So he rushes to give a ridiculous recommendation. And the phrasing in the Hebrew here is strange. It's disjointed and not written the way it normally would be. And you can kind of see that in the English too. In verse 7, and Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let these things be done. Like, that's a strange way to begin that sentence. And the impression there is that Haman is so excited that he can barely get the words out. He can barely wait to come up with all these wonderful ideas for how he should be honored. So, for the man whom the king delights to honor, dress him in the king's robes, put the crown upon his head, put him on the king's horse, parade him through the streets, and have high officials shouting to everyone around, so this is done to the man whom the king delights to honor. It's pretty self-aggrandizing, since Haman thinks this is what's going to happen to him. And it's even worse than it looks. By all this emphasis on the king's clothing, which sounds a little bit strange to us maybe, there's a lot of undertones here that we need to appreciate. The Persians had kind of a superstitious belief that the clothing of a king imbued some kind of royal power to him. It was mystical. It was almost spiritual. That it was a garment that gave him something extra. And so asking to be clothed in that is a big request. It's a big thing. Asking to be put upon the king's horse and to wear the king's crown and for everyone to see you dressed up just like the king, I can only think of two reasons why Haman wants this. The more sympathetic one is that he's trying to show the people, I am the king's successor. When Ahasuerus is gone, look who fits so well into this robe. Look who looks so great with this crown on his head. I'm the next natural king. And that fits pretty well into the character of Haman, that he's so arrogant that of course he would want the crown. Of course he would want the throne. Because he's not satisfied with any amount of power as long as there's more to be grabbed. But I think the second possibility is that he's thinking even bigger than that. He's not going to wait around for Ahasuerus to be gone. That this could be the opening steps of a coup. That he is actually wanting to usurp the throne and to push Ahasuerus out. Clearly Ahasuerus is not particularly competent. And so maybe this will be an opportunity for Haman to start whipping the crowd up in support of him. And sooner rather than later, he can reign and Ahasuerus can be gone. Whichever way it is, it's clear that Haman is quite arrogant. And it's clear that he's asking for a lot in hopes that he can be honored in, frankly, a ridiculous way. Let's keep reading verses 10 through 14. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Haman's arrogance costs him. He has built up this reward so much without even knowing who it's for that he is forced to honor his enemy. This isn't just something that happens to Mordecai. He's the one who has to carry it out because Haman specified that a high official ought to do it. And, well, he's a high official. So it's some irony there that he's forced to honor his enemy rather than kill him. He's not able to proceed with this plan at all. He can't ask the king now to kill Mordecai. How does that conversation even go? Ahasuerus may be incompetent, but not that incompetent. Like, he's just honored him. You can't have him publicly executed and disgraced mere minutes later. So Haman returns home. Defeated. And this is a big turning point in the narrative. From here on, you know, from before this point, Haman is scheming and plotting and things are getting worse for the Jews. We see a little bit of overlap where Esther is working to try to counter that, but chapter 6 is where things tip over to the other side. That Haman is now out of control. His plans are not working and Esther's plans are proceeding. Until she's able to save her people. Haman ends up disgraced and executed. Mordecai ends up promoted, and the Jews are saved. So why did it all happen this way? Was it because of Esther's plan? Partially. At least partially. Esther's plan was a good one. There was a lot of wisdom in it. There was a lot of savvy in it. And she was careful about how she planned this out. But her plan was not enough. At best, she would have been able to save herself and her people, but not Mordecai. See, if Esther had proceeded the way that she intended to, then she had the first feast where Haman and the king were there, but she's biding her time to really ask for what she wants, which we already discussed why that was a good idea. Then the second feast is supposed to happen the next day. But in between, we have Haman inserting this additional plan where he's going to come to the king early in the morning, ask for Mordecai to be killed. Ahasuerus is probably going to say yes, because he said yes to every single request that's ever been asked of him. And if he's already authorized the death of an entire group of people, an entire ethnicity, what does he care about one individual person? Haman can probably talk Ahasuerus into it. And so by the time Esther gets to the second banquet, where the king and Haman are, Mordecai is already dead, and his body's rotting on a stick. Esther's plan is not good enough. Through no fault of her own. She didn't know that Haman was planning that. She didn't know that he had another plan in the works to kill Mordecai. And you know, it might not have even worked out that well. If Haman had been able to score that kind of victory, it's possible that he would have been able to outmaneuver her at the second banquet and convince Ahasuerus that Esther should not be trusted and that the Jews still needed to be killed. And so it's possible that she wouldn't have saved anyone at all. A series of fortunate coincidences helped out perfectly. But were they really coincidences? Were they really good fortune? Why is it that the king had insomnia on that fateful night? Why is it that instead of resorting to any of the entertainment that a king could ask for, including the large harem that he has and the large riches that he has, the servants he has to be able to provide anything that he wants, why is it that to cure his insomnia he asks for the records to be read? I can't imagine that was a common event. Why is it that when the records were read, out of all the records of the kingdom, they happened to tell him about the failed assassination attempt? Why is it that in those records, Mordecai's name was even mentioned? Do you know how easy it would have been for his name to be omitted? Because it's actually Queen Esther who told the king directly. And so when the records were made before, it could have just been Esther's name there with no mention of Mordecai, and then these events wouldn't have happened this way. Why is it that Haman rushes to the king so early in the morning to be the first of his advisors there? Why is it that when they come in, that it's King Ahasuerus who speaks first? Why is it that he speaks so vaguely so that Haman doesn't know who he's trying to honor? Why is it that Haman comes up with this ridiculous plot? You see a lot of coincidences here. A lot of strange things all strung together to perfectly fill in the gap where Esther's plan could not. I said earlier that Esther and Mordecai are not really the heroes of the book of Esther. And I believe that. I believe that the true hero of the story is God. The invisible, unseen hand of providence. How God is in control. He fills in the gaps. He protects his people. His name may never be mentioned in the book, not directly, but the biggest turning point in the book has nothing at all to do with anything that Esther and Mordecai do. They didn't make him have insomnia. They didn't make the records happen that way. They didn't make any of those things happen. All that was a coincidence. Why would the book of Esther be given to us to glorify coincidences? What kind of lesson is that for us? Do the best you can and hope luck works out. That's not much of a lesson. That's not much of a benefit to us as Christians. Yet we're given this book not just as a legend of where Purim comes from, not to glorify Esther and Mordecai, because honestly, they're kind of lackluster heroes because they're not a part of the biggest turning point here. If this is a legend, it's not a very good one. It's more than that. It's about how Esther and Mordecai embolden themselves to do what is right, to take courage, to work up a good plan, and how even though their plan is not enough, God is there. God fills in the gaps. God protects his people. God is a God of reversal. He can reverse situations that seem set in stone. The Jews were in grave danger. Mordecai's life was hanging in the balance. Esther and Mordecai knew that things were bad, but they did not realize the full extent of the danger facing them. But God did. God knows our lives even better than we do. He is infinitely aware of our successes, our failures, our struggles, the dangers facing us. By the invisible hand of providence, He directs the rise and fall of nations. But not just world events, not just big things like that. It's also the individual lives of His people. That doesn't mean that our choices don't matter, and don't come away from here thinking that. That God moves us around like pawns and that nothing we do ever makes a difference. It certainly does. God expects us to act righteously and wisely. But I don't have to have perfect faith in my ability to foresee everything that can happen. I don't have to have perfect faith in my competence, because I can't foresee everything. My plan might not be good enough. God makes the difference. God fills in the gaps. When our best efforts aren't good enough, like Esther's weren't good enough, God sees and God makes up the difference. You know, God is a God of reversal. As I said, He's capable of reversing huge problems. He reversed the huge problems facing the Jews, but He can reverse huge problems facing you today. One of the big themes in Scripture is how we are transformed from darkness to light. We are chained to sin, with minds twisted and distorted to follow Satan. And yes, sin changes you. It really, truly does. And many a person has cried out from the depths of sin, saying, "I am too evil. I am too wicked. I could never be whom God wants me to be." God changes hearts. We have to want it. We have to seek it. Like we talked about this morning, we have to be persistent in our pursuit of truth. That matters. It really does. But even when you feel trapped in your sin, God can change you. God makes up the difference. Turn to Him and be free. If there's anything we can do to help you tonight, we hope that you will turn to God and you will be free from your sin. If you're ready to become a Christian, then you can be one tonight. You don't have to leave here still lost in your sin. You can be buried in water and have those sins washed away. Or if there's sin in your life that you need to repent of as a Christian, or something that we can help you with, prayers we can offer for you, we will petition God on your behalf. And God is good. God is great. He will be with you. Come, as together we stand and sing.